everyone. Welcome to the Fiction Lab. We are an online writers community. We do webinars, workshops, live writing sessions, book clubs, critique groups, coaching calls, a ton of everything. It's a really fun time over there. You should join our Discord. Please check us out. We actually had this awesome opportunity to interview and ask our writing questions of Jim Butcher, the author of the Dresden Files series. I'm actually going to drop a link here so you can check out his book if you are interested. Purchasing it through this link, by the way, goes through bookshop.org, so your purchases all go directly to local bookstores and support local bookstores, so shop local. But yeah, we got to chat with him. We did a live stream. I got to interview him, and everybody who's a member of our Discord got to ask him their writing questions, which was phenomenal. And he was super nice, super generous, and just shared a wealth of knowledge. So yeah, here's that. Stick around to the end because I've got a few announcements if you're interested in learning more about the Fiction Lab, or we're also going to be launching an anthology soon, so you can find out more information about that at the end. Thanks. All right. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Fiction Lab. We've got Jim Butcher here helping us.
How y'all doing? So
we're going to learn some tips from writing from a pro. We actually, Jim, our book club this month is Stormfront. Okay. So we're going to be meeting to chat about that next week. Very excited. And so yeah, everyone here in the chat are all writers. Everybody's writing anything from fantasy to sci-fi to thriller. We even got a nonfiction writer in here too, which is fun. Okay. So yeah, we're gonna keep it open for audience Q&A, and Leighton's gonna pop up some really good questions for us. But I actually am gonna pop off with a question first. So I actually met you at OWFI a couple months ago. Right. You were the keynote speaker. And one of the things that you talked about, you walked us through your like big middle plot arc. And I'm wondering if you could walk through that with the gang here today, because I think some of them could find that really beneficial.
Right. Okay. The basic idea of writing the using the structural device called the big middle, and it's the one that I use for everything that I do, is that the middle of the book tends to wander, especially when you're a new writer. You often find yourself sort of flailing around trying to get to your finale. The idea of the big middle is that you plan kind of a great big dramatic event for about the middle of the book, and that event will be the event that kind of kicks off the roller coaster to get you to your climax. So if we're talking about the Dresden book Deadbeat, the big middle is the zombie attack on Harry's apartment. That's where the big middle starts, and then everything else, the big middle drives everything else from there. So it works like that in a lot of things. The big middle of the original Star Wars movie is rescuing Leia from the space station. You know, you get captured on the Death Star, and that's the big middle, is that whole rescue sequence off of the Death Star. And you'll see this in story after story, you know, movie after movie. That's one of the devices that they use. So the way you do it is essentially you plan to have a great big dramatic event that's going to happen in the middle of the book that will yet be not quite as high as your climax. But if you think of it like a roller coaster, you're sort of, you know, you kind of begin at the beginning as you're on your beginning track that's kind of slow and easy. And then you kind of start building that chunk going up the track to build up that momentum that you're going to need. That's essentially what you do. And then when you get to the big middle, that's the part where the roller coaster starts down and does all the cool fun stuff. But it sort of makes you focus on getting all your story elements built up, because, you know, you're going to want to have all the story elements that you're going to need for your climax need to be built into the book by the time you get to your big middle. And then after you get to the big middle, the rest of the book tends to be a fairly easy thing to write. It also keeps you from getting lost. It does all kinds of good things for you as a writer.
Oh, I really like that. We're currently working on an anthology release. And so a lot of them, I talked about that on one of our group coaching calls after you showed me that. And I noticed a lot of them were trying to implement that into their little short stories, which was really great.
Yeah.
Okay, so popping over to some audience questions, some questions from members of the lab. Do you have a favorite time to write, or are you someone who locks yourself in a room and goes at it for hours?
The way I tend to do it that's most successful, I will sit down and I'll sit down. The first thing I do in the morning will be to sit down and write. And I'll say, okay, you got to sit down and write until either you've hit your quota for the day or you get to 250 words. And if it's working well, then I'll often finish things off right there that morning. And, you know, I'll be done by then. If not, then if I get to 250 words and I'm just not feeling it and I'm not quite sure where I'm going. And you know, when the gears are grinding, when you're trying to write, everybody's familiar with that. So if I get to that point, then as soon as I get to 250, I'll be okay. I'm done. I'll quit for now. And then I'll do other stuff. I'll do other writer stuff. I'll do publicity stuff. I'll sign pages, you know, that sort of thing. And I'll break for lunch. Maybe go out and go for a walk and get a little exercise. And then I'll come back in the afternoon, at the beginning of the afternoon, and I'll sit down and say, okay, you're going to go until you get to your quota or you hit 250 words. And then I'll keep going. And if it's working great, then I'll finish up by then. And if it isn't, I'll get to 250 words and say, okay, that's enough. Quit torturing yourself. And then if I haven't hit it by then, when I go to bed that night, I'll take the laptop with me. And I'll sit in bed and I'll say, okay, you go till you hit your quota, you get to 250 words. And if I get to 250 words or if I get to my quota, which is usually 1500 or 2000 is kind of what I tend to write my chapters about that long. And that's what I want to do as a chapter a day. And if I get to there, then great. And if I haven't, I've still got 750 words done. Not like, you know, I mean, I'm still producing well. I mean, if you can do 500 words a day, you're writing a couple of books a year. So my most successful technique is to do it like that. And that's what I've been doing more of recently. And that's why I've gotten so much done this year. You know, I'm up to about 70,000 words finished this year, you know, already. And the speed keeps building, you know, so as I'm getting more and more into it, kind of refine my technique. And I'm hoping to finish the next Dresden before the end of the year, because I'm just going to go straight into that one now.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I noticed today they announced the cover dropped the cover for, I actually have that queued up so people can see it.
They put me in USA Today for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is awesome. This cover looks amazing, by the way. And Dresden always looks so awesome in that hat. So just kudos to whoever has your cover. Right.
I swear the big trilogy at the end, he's actually going to have a hat for a reason. And okay. I'm sure they're going to put him on the cover without one at that point.
Oh yeah. That'll be the time that he's not wearing it on the cover.
Yeah.
No, that cover looks amazing. That looks great. And that comes out January next year, right?
That's correct.
Okay, cool.
Yeah it's exciting. Available for pre-order now. I think it's January 20.
Awesome. Yeah. Exciting. Okay. Back to questions. I got easily distracted with that cover and had to bring it up. So, okay. So Aubrey here has a question about, she says, I'd love to hear what the most challenging part of writing or being a writer is for you.
For me, it's all the writer stuff that I have to do that isn't actually writing, because it eats up so much of my brain and so much of my time. So, and I don't mean like the research stuff and so on, because I love to do that. Research is fun. But it's all the, it's stuff like today, you know, like what I'm doing with you guys today. It's interviews. It's filling out, you know, it's filling out stuff for magazines and so on, you know, answering for them. 'Cause all the PR stuff is stuff that you kind of, you know, I mean, it's always kind of a high wire act. And if you do something wrong, there could be serious consequences. So, you know, it's kind of sort of a high tension thing. And also I have to go out and be like this very friendly public persona, because this isn't the actual Jim Butcher that you know, in my real life. You know, this is famous guy, Jim Butcher. Famous guy, Jim Butcher, like, remembers people's names and, you know, is charming and thoughtful and does things like that in public. In real life, I'm, you know, I might say a couple or 300, even 300 whole words in a single day, you know. I like to sit down. I'm pretty much a hermit. I like being at home. You know, the last month or so, I can count the number of times I've left the house on one hand.
Yeah, you've got a nice cozy space right there. So
I like my home. People are always, well, where are you going to go on vacation? It's like vacation. I'm going to do a staycation. I like where I live. It's happy here. It's everything's predictable and I know where it is.
That's always nice. Okay. So next question, we've got one from Bill here. What techniques do you use when plotting at the scene level? And what do you think of the motivation reaction unit formula? He says, thank you. I love your books. All three, Dresden, Spires, and Alera.
The motivation reaction unit formula is, I learned it as the stimulus response formula. And stimulus response is the fundamental of all writing. All writing is based on something happens and then your character responds to it. And you have to do it, you know, in that order, especially on the written page. You can get away with a little bit more of having characters react, you know, like in this on the screen, you can get away with that a little bit more because Spielberg is famous for that. You know, he'll have the people staring and then you get to see whatever it is they're staring at, you know. But when you're writing, stimulus response is the very basic building block of sentences, of paragraphs, of scenes. And that's how you have to work. Yeah. Can I see the rest of the question again?
Oh, yeah. Layton, will you pop that back up? I unstarred it like an idiot. Here it is. I found it. So what techniques do you use when plotting?
The techniques I use when plotting at the scene level are pretty basic. I use the plot structure that I was taught by Debbie Chester in college. And that is, you have a point of view character. That point of view character is the character who has the most on the line emotionally with whatever's going on in the scene. Mm. The point of view character enters into a conflict with somebody who is actively working against the point of view character getting done whatever it is they want to get done. And they have a goal that they're trying to meet. And then at the end of that scene, they've either met the goal or they haven't. And there's a number of different outcomes for the scene. And when characters get their goals all the time, that's boring. You know, nobody likes to read about that. So what you want is the way I've learned it is that the scene question is always, is the character going to get to their goal? And the answer yes is boring. So you don't want to use that one. The next best answer is yes, but. And if you get to a yes, but, that means the characters accomplished their goal, but they've done something that is going to complicate the story for them later on.
Yeah.
The next best answer is no, the character just flat out doesn't get it. And that means your character is going to have to stop and reevaluate and try and find another way over, around, or through the problem. And then the very best answer of all is no, and furthermore, not only did they not get what they were after, but they somehow made things worse. And that is my very favorite answer to scenes. Those are the four basic outcomes for any scene that you can have. And the only time you're allowed to use yes is when you get to the very end of the story. And at the very end of the story, you can have your character say yes, because that's the resolution, you know, when your character gets whatever goal it is they've been after the entire story arc. And that's when you can say, here it is. And everybody goes, oh, what a relief.
Yeah, I think as I was reading through this for our book club, this is probably my third or fourth read through. Originally, I've done the audiobooks with Marsters. Phenomenal. Mm-hmm.
He's amazing. Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah, he's so good. He's who I heard as I was reading this the whole time. I noticed
he's synonymous now. Yeah.
Yeah. He's hairy. And something I noticed that you did really well was we've got these moments at the end of every chapter where you're giving us that no. And then we might get like some sort of answer that covers it well enough to move us on to the next chapter, which I loved. You're just like just taunting us with it all the way to the end. But every chapter ends in a sort of way that's like, I've been dangling this carrot. You don't get to have it anymore. And
right.
Yeah. Love that. Okay. We've got a question from Claire. So Claire asks, how you keep your world, characters, and magic system organized? Do you have like a series Bible or a wiki? How do you keep all that those notes together?
I had a notebook that I kept everything in for a long time. And then I worked out that the readers are way better about it than I am. So at this point, I just use the fan wiki because there's folks out there who, you know, they live and breathe this stuff. I mean, for me, it's work.
Yeah.
you know, but for the people for whom it's fun, they're the ones who are going. I mean, so I highly recommend you get somebody who really loves your story and ask for their help, because people will get very excited about that sort of thing. But originally I kept everything on, in notebooks and on old style D&D character sheets.
Brilliant.
And, yeah, I would have a D&D character sheet. I initially rolled up all these characters. You know, I rolled up Harry with a 16 intelligence and an 18 constitution. So I'm like, okay, he's going to be a wizard and get beat up a lot.
That's perfect. Did you roll up Bob? What was Bob's? Just full charisma?
Oh no, Bob wasn't rolled up as a character like that. Bob was kind of a, I always thought of Bob as Harry's assistant AI.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. So we've got one from Retro Rents Al. So one last one from him. He's currently knee deep in his process. How do you approach revision differently from your first drafts?
My process is kind of front loaded. So when I sit down to start writing, I generally, I can't get anywhere until I can see the whole chapter in my head ahead of time. So, you know, I'll sit there, you know, kind of tinkering with the words at the beginning of a chapter, but it won't really take off until I can see the whole thing and I know what's going to happen. And then I write it, and I keep it very much locked to that same formula: point of view, character, goal, conflict, setback. And that's what I do every time. And as a result, I generally don't have, you know, all of my revisions tend to be like small stuff, like, hey, this legal detail doesn't work like that, you need to fix it, for example, you know, in some of the stories that I'm getting Dresden involved with the law and some novellas that I'm writing right now. And so the lawyer will say, oh, I don't understand how this is working right now. Here's how the legal process would go. And I'll be, okay, now I need to go back and fix the legal process. But it tends to be a fairly short fix without a whole lot on my part to do, you know, just kind of change a few details. And the story, structurally speaking, the story's sound because I've stuck to that outline, to the basic craft outline. So that doesn't usually hurt very much. My revisions tend to be fairly light because I put more thought into it ahead of time.
Yeah. Oh, that's helpful. I think for me, it's copious notes because then I can always go back and reference them at any time.
It's very true.
Too many notes. okay, so next one we've got from Tysarian. What inspired your characters? How did you come up with them?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I just kind of make them. I need people. I know what kind of story I want to tell. And I try and find the person who is either going to be best or worst suited for that story, and then start from there. Originally, when I made Harry Dresden, he was a complete Frankenstein character, because I was writing him for a project in class, and my whole point was I was trying to prove to my teacher how wrong she was about everything that she was teaching me. And so the way I decided to do it, because, you know, I was about 25 and I knew everything then. And the way I decided to do it was I said, okay, you know what? I'm just going to do everything she tells me to. And so she had told us how to build characters. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to fill out this little worksheet exactly the way she has. And so basically I was going to be writing a wizard PI. So I took like my top three favorite wizards and my top three favorite PIs. And then I just sort of chopped them to bits and then I took my favorite bits from all of them and just stuck them together. And then called it good. There's my character right there. And I was so eager to show her, you know, what terrible cookie cutter pablum craft would emerge from a process so rigid and wooden. And so I wrote the first book of the Dresden Files, and which showed her. And
yeah, here you are. Many books then?
Yeah. Plus, at this point, I'm a little scared to do anything she didn't tell me to do. It's worked out so well. How could I?
Exactly. Okay, so we've got one from Chris, and he asks, what's the most difficult thing about writing a series character like Dresden?
The hardest part, there's two parts that are difficult. One is figuring out how to scale it so that you don't have him showing up, you know, with amazing superpowers in one book and then he just doesn't have them in the next book for whatever reason. You know, you want it to be consistent and logical and for things to build to an appropriate climax for not just for each book, but also for the series. So, you know, every book I'm writing has to be, you know, like the next step up that I'm doing. And if you start going down like that, then it's not going to be fun and interesting. So that was the first thing, and the way you get around that is you plan what you want to happen at the end, and what Dresden's going to be doing for his big, his great big, you know, thunder, blood and thunder stuff at the very end of the book, and you just sort of start scaling him up that way a bit at a time, you know, and that meant that I could start him off way less powerful and way less, you know, able to do the things that he could do and way less savvy, and that has given me places to go every book. The other thing that's hard about it is continuity. Continuity is it's very difficult. It's very different. You know, I got to the end of 12 days and somebody pointed out a tiny continuity error that from two books previous that I had missed because I hadn't read the two books previous soon enough. And so I was like, okay, yeah, you're right. I have to change this detail. So I had to, you know, literally rework how some of the stuff in the magic system works. But I was able to make it fit in, you know, it's like, okay, well, if I twist this detail like this, I'll be able to Jenga this right in there.
That's a Dresden thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. And because, I mean, yeah, a lot of this stuff is, I like when I come up against an inconsistency like that, I like to regard it as a creative challenge for myself.
I like that.
Generally speaking, whenever I run into anything like that, I like to look at that and go, I've got an opportunity to do something really cool here. Let me see if I can sort out how to do something cool with this and make it a part of the ongoing story and not just make this a mistake. And then people go, ooh, he's so deep. He thought of it all ahead of time. And I'm like, right. Yes, I did. I thought of
yes.
It
all. Here's your tin foil. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But you've got to be, I know there's a lot of people who like to plan and outline everything, but over something so long, I don't know that anything but the most general outline would have been able to hold together. So, I mean, I've known generally where the story is going. Like I know the headlines in Dresden's story world in the Midwest Arcane, you know, the newspaper, which is probably a blog now at this point. But I know the headlines in that for the books that are for the events that are still coming. A lot of the specifics I don't. I have to plot those as I get into them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
But keeping that continuity is the hard part.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine. Okay, so we've got one from Shadow Dream here. How do you deal with burnout when life kicks you around and saps up the creative energy? When is the passion there but words aren't? It's a great question.
It is a good question. I wrote a book about it, is what I did. 12 months is a book that's about that. You know, it's about how do you get yourself back when you've had your legs taken out from under you by life. That's happened to me a couple of times. And what can I tell you except that you've got to. I mean, imagine it'll be different for different people. But for me, it was learning how to take good care of myself and how to be kind to myself. How to stop flagellating myself about not getting writing done and accept that sometimes, you know, when bad emotional stuff happens to you, you know, it does damage to your brain and you're mm-hmm. going to have to figure out ways around that. And the only way, and the way to do that is it's the same way as if you get a physical injury. You know, I've had a bad shoulder injury before. And the way I had to come back from that was kind of starting slow. I had to start slow and light and doing very light exercises and eventually sort of working myself up to more and more. So my advice to you is be kind to yourself. You know, if you can get 250 words a day done, you know, or just even if it's not every day, if you can get a few words done that day, a sentence done that day, you're still a sentence closer to the end of the book than you were before. And that's still progress. And just be happy with that small progress that you make. And eventually, as you kind of sort things out and, you know, you kind of get your own emotional issues resolved and figure out how to, you know, how you're going to, you know, embrace life again and do kind things for yourself again, you'll be able to get back to it. You know, for me, it was like I did a lot of whitewater rafting because that's something that I find really enjoyable and fun, you know, and you can almost die while you're doing it. So that's kind of interesting. And just sort of got out and tried some new things and kind of reminded myself that my life was not all about, you know, kind of that small box that I had found myself put in and had gone out and tried new stuff and found out that there was more to life than that.
Yeah. And something you brought up during OWFI, like in your keynote, you talked about new experiences helping fuel your writing.
Very much so.
Yeah. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more for the members?
anything that you do that you can go out and experience and sort of trust yourself and teach yourself to try something that you haven't done before is going to provide you with something for your writing. It doesn't have to be stuff that you go out and spend money on. The example my teacher always used was drive out to the country somewhere, find a place where there's a bunch of woods and there's not a bunch of lights, and go out there around sundown, and then just sit down with your back to the woods and wait. And experience that. Figure out what that is like. Figure out what that does for you and to you. And that is something that you're going to be able to take to your writing that is going to teach you something that you didn't know before. But yeah, if you can, get out, try new experiences. Go out and try new food somewhere that you haven't tried before. Go out and try new stuff that you haven't done. There's all kinds of different things that you can do, but anything that you can do where you can actually get your hands onto it and mm-hmm. experience what's going on, and engage your senses in what you're doing, it's going to make you a better writer. Because, you know, if you've gone to the gun range and fired a pistol down range and had somebody teach you how to do that, you're going to know, okay, this is how a gun works. This is what the propellant smells like. This is what it feels like when it kicks in your hand. Here's how hard it is to aim. And that's the sort of thing that is going to teach you stuff that you're going to need to know. And so anything you can, I mean, I don't know what it's like to risk my life in war in the woods somewhere. But I do know what it's like to dress up as a goblin and lurk in ambush in a national park in some bushes while I'm waiting for a party of player characters to come by at a LARP. And to be able to do that, thinking of, okay, he's going to be right there. He's going to be about 25 feet away. If I crouch like this, my feet are going to fall asleep. But if I sit, I'm not going to be able to get up on time. And to sort of try and figure out, how am I going to do this so that this will be the most effective. And suddenly you know something, you know a little bit more than you did before about what it's like for that fantasy character to be involved in that fantasy, life or death action. And you're going to be able to bring little things to that that are going to seem real to the reader. And if you can bring the little things along that seem real, mm-hmm. It's going to make them buy into the big things as well.
Yeah, it's really just write what you know. And if you aren't going out and experiencing new things, you don't know anything.
Right. Yeah. Go learn stuff. Learning stuff is great.
It's good for our health. Yeah. Okay. So we've got one. How do you manage character arcs over a single novel and then across a whole series? How do you keep long-running relationships interesting?
Okay. Character arcs over a single novel, I sort of misunderstood what my teacher said when she talked about character arcs. So the way that I did them was I would, for each character, I would have, Dresden, I would have the antagonist, and then I would have Dresden's sidekick and maybe one or two other sort of, larger characters that were in the book. And I would just draw an arc that started at one page. And I said, here's where they're starting. And, as it went on, I would say, here's where they start, where they ended at the previous book. And then I would just sort of, I would know where I wanted them to start and where I wanted them to finish. And then I would just sort of draw tick marks along the way of events that would logically help you get from here to there. And I would do that for each character, for each plot in the book. And then I would make I would get one of those big art pads and draw a great big arc. And then I would put all those tick points along the way. And that would be how I would arrange from each character arc, from each subplot arc. And that would be how I would arrange it for the story and how I would know what I would need to be writing next for each one. As far as doing it over a series, you just have to put in some thought. Like if I've got a character who hasn't shown up for a few books, I don't want them to show up the same as they were the last time we saw them. Things are going to have changed for them. And so you kind of have to stop and write some notes and say, and come up with some stories, at least in your head, for those characters to say, okay, well, this is what's been happening with Butters from here to there. Since the last time we saw him, here's what Sonya's been doing. And that way, when the characters come in and they're a little bit different, or they have a different haircut, or, you know, in the, the new generation of Star Wars movies where C-3PO is like, you're probably wondering why I have a red arm, and they just skip over it. But you know, as a writer, you want to do stuff like that. You want to talk to the character. You want to, you know, kind of sit down with the character and talk to him and say, okay, well, what have you been doing for the past 2 years? Because that's how long it's been since we've seen you. And so that's how you get those characters. You know, that's how you get them to seem real, is because they don't just stop while they're off screen. You know, you have to think they've still got their own history going. They've still got their own story happening. And when you've done that, you don't want to make it anything that's like too big. You know, like they suddenly became a blind monk. You know, you don't want that to happen. But you want them to have had enough change that the reader goes, oh, these guys have their own life that's going on outside, you know, what Dresden is doing all by himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love that. Okay, let's see. We've got another one from Chris here. What are some things about writing you know now that you wish you'd known at the beginning of your career?
More and more, I'm convinced that simplicity is one of the best things you can have with writing. More and more, keep it simple, stupid is the rule. You know, you don't have to get things. You don't have to be really involved. You don't have to be really intricate. You don't have to. There's nothing wrong with giving someone a story that they can anticipate and expect. The subversion of expectations is one of those things that I often find it's really hard to do well, because the whole point of a story is you're sort of making a contract with the reader, right? I'm going to take you on this ride. All these terrible things are going to happen, but it's going to be okay. You know, that's kind of that's your basic contract with the reader. When you get to the end of this, you're going to feel good. And a lot of people, I think they work so hard to subvert expectations that they forget to tell the good story while they're doing it. And I think we've seen that a lot in Hollywood recently. There's nothing wrong with telling a story that a smart reader is going to be able to read and say, oh, I know that how this is going to end. I know how this is going to end. Because then when it ends the way they thought, they're going to go, yes, I'm good. I'm a smart reader. I did this. There's nothing at all wrong with that. I suppose when you get to mysteries, there would probably be a problem with being too predictable on mysteries. But it's very, very... You know, being able to conceal what's going to happen is very, very easy. You know, it's a matter of when you get to the end of the book, going back in and adding just a wisp of fog here or a little highlight on a small detail there. And then people will go, oh, the writer was so brilliant. Look at what they did. He tricked me here. He did this here. But I really think that writing is one of those things that's very straightforward. It's writing a good story is simple. It's not easy, but it's very simple.
I really like that. Simple, but not easy.
Yes.
I'm going to make that a sticker.
Yeah. Simple, not easy has been my theme as a writer.
I feel like there's a line from that. Very similar. Nothing is ever easy. I think at one point, like Dresden makes that comment. Very relevant. Okay. So we've got another one from Anna here. And Anna asks, how do you take the idea from your head and put it into an outline? How detailed is an outline for you?
My basic outline for a Dresden Files book is I know where the book's going to begin and what the situation is going to be at the beginning of the book. I know where the book's going to end and what the situation is going to be at the end of the book. I know the big middle that I have planned out. I'll have a great big dramatic flashy scene planned out for the middle. I usually know four or five wiseacre remarks I want Dresden to make along the way. I pick out which character is going to be like the most suitable sidekick, because Dresden generally has a sidekick in every book. And I figure out which character is going to be the most suitable sidekick and then start kind of, you know, doing a little bit with their story as well. I want to know where their story is going to begin, where it's going to end, you know, what's going to be the big, you know, their moment of crisis. And that's pretty much all I need to get going. After that, it's just a matter of picking, you know, which characters are going to be the most fun to use, making up a new bad guy or two. And that's generally how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So my outlines are fairly loose. Where they're not loose is where I get into the structure on a scene by scene basis. That's not something I try not to compromise on that. You know, I'm writing my scenes, I'm writing sequels. They both have a very specific structure and I use them all the time.
Yeah. So kind of going into scenes, how do you inject conflict into those when everyone present is on the exact same side?
Oh, well, that's easy. I mean, most folks have some families. They can understand that somebody who's in the family, who's on your side, can still fight with you, mm-hmm. you know, and they can do it sincerely and, you know, without being a jerk about it, but still, you know, provide that conflict. And I do that a lot, you know. Karen Murphy was a minor antagonist in terms of writing craft for Dresden the first several books. You know, I mean, she was there to get in the way and cause him problems. And you know, that was her job. She was a sub antagonist. And yet, you know, they were friends. She liked him and respected him. They got along all right. But that was her role because she had different concerns. She had different priorities and thought different things were important than Dresden did. And as a result, mm-hmm. conflict comes out of that. As long as you have people who, and that's the main thing, is you have people who think different things are more important on the important things list. So for Harry Dresden, for him, you know, doing the right thing in whatever the situation is and what he judges as the ethically right solution to a situation, that's the most important thing for him. You know, at the beginning of the series, Murphy's most important thing is her devotion to law and order and making mm-hmm. sure that the law is followed and that people are protected under the law. You know, and just those two things can cause plenty of conflict.
Yeah, I think you can bring in a lot of each character's misbelief. Like whatever Harry's misbelief is versus Karen's, and then that creates
absolutely.
Innately yep. attention.
Because the whole point is, as long as you're making your characters with flaws, those flaws will come out and cause conflict. Mm-hmm. So I mean, it's so important to make your characters flawed, and I can't emphasize that enough. Anything that you watch, that you see, that you see on TV, and you go, "Wow, that was boring." Ask yourself, what were the flaws of the main characters in that boring thing that you just watched? And you're going to find yourself going, they didn't really have any, you know, and the same thing is like with quirks, you know, weird little individual details that are specific and strange to them. And what were their quirks? Oh, well, they didn't really have any. It's like, yeah. So that's a recipe for bland right there.
Yeah. And I think, Vonnegut talks about like making every character want something in as every scene, make them want something and keep them from it. And I think that's another really great way to help build conflict, especially when you have two characters who are on the same side.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When you've got opposing goals or goals that are, even if they're not diametrically opposed, you know, if you're hitting at this angle, it's going to cause complications for the story. And that's what it makes it inherently interesting. All stories mm-hmm. are about conflict. And if you don't have the conflict, you can't get it done.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we've got a question from Claire, and she asks, for the short story collections and those in anthologies, is writing a short story interfering with the process of writing the novel, and are those planned into the series or not?
Short stories are almost never planned. They're almost all of my short stories are ideas that I had that I wanted to use, but which would not have been appropriate for a novel. Generally speaking, they were too big and would interfere in the overplot of a novel, or the overplot of the series, or they were too small and just would just be a distraction from the novel. So I would take those ideas of the various monsters and supernatural beings and so on, and I sort of stuff those over to one side, and so I've got this bin of things that I will pluck out when I want to write a short story. So those are stuff that I throw in along the way. And I generally, you know, the Dresden Files books are generally, you know, Harry Dresden's worst weekend of the year. And that's kind of the way I think about a Dresden Files book. But, you know, he's got a whole nother year, you know, between novels. So I generally try mm-hmm. and pick where I'm going to put, you know, this story in those, in, you know, this short story, where it's going to fit inside the over scheme. Lately, I've just sort of been putting them between novels as I've been writing novels. So, you know, I've gotten two short stories and a novella done since I finished 12 months. And, you know, and I'm going to get started on my next novel because things are really, really flowing well right now. And I like that.
That's great.
But so I'm able to say, okay, here's where Dresden finished at the end of the last book. I'm going to put this short story here, this novella here, this novel here. Here we go. Or you know, the second short story here, and here we go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So Sydney So it looks like Sydney was at OWFI as well. Hi, Sydney. You mentioned that you mentor other writers. How do you select your mentees, and where do you recommend writers look to find a mentor?
I select my mentees based purely on instinct. I only have a couple or three at a time because I just don't have time for anything else. And you know, I try and get about 25 pages done every couple of weeks of helping them work on their writing. I'll sit there and talk to them about, you know, about writing structure and you know, story structure and how to use that to their advantage. I'll take a scene that they've written that doesn't match up to story structure and say, okay, here's why this scene starts to drag, and there's stuff happening here that you know, you've started and begun this story within the same page. You started and ended the story within the same page. And what you need, this is a good story, but what you need to do is introduce it here, have a complicating part of it here, and then pull the ending of it out over here. And that's going to give people a lot more emotional satisfaction than when you just have suddenly somebody suddenly turn into an ally for this character, for example. It's like your instincts about making this character an ally who's going to support your protagonist are correct, but you still need to, draw out the story. You need to tease people with it a little bit more until you deliver on that ending.
Mm-hmm.
I select them based on instinct. If I were you, if you're reading any writers that are just getting started, writers like that often have more time on their hands. So you might be able to go to them and say, hey, I would love to be able to talk to you about writing sometime. Don't go up to them and say, I want to be a mentor. Tease them out a while. You know, we're doing more story stuff here. But if you go to them and say, hey, I would love to talk to you about writing sometime. Do you think we could have an exchange by email or something like that? Email is important. Writers are generally tend to be introverted hermits. And I mean, they're almost certain to say yes, because most young writers, one of the things you need to do to get better as a writer is teach people how to write, because it will help you understand how it works better as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we have spaces for that in the fiction lab. So keep a lookout.
Places like this. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got one from Helen here, and she asks, what's one of the biggest differences you notice between being a new writer and the experienced writer you are now in terms of writing?
Wow. The guy I was when I started writing was so willing to take on a lot of different things that he knew absolutely nothing about. Because he was writing, he was like, it's just fiction. You know, if somebody gets upset about it, why worry? I mean, I'm writing dumb little wizard books. What's the issue here? This is not world shaking. And so now there's a lot of things there's a lot of topics that I would not be nearly as willing to write about now. I'd be a lot more careful because I've learned more about them. There is a certain invincibility that comes along with ignorance that I sort of wish I had these days. That's sort of one of the things. He was a lot more confident. I'm less confident, but more competent at this point. I think I know a little bit better what I can and can't do well. Whereas before, I would just try anything and just be like, whatever, I'm writing stories. The whole cool part of this is we're going to have a big zombie T-Rex at the end of the story. That's the important thing. And so that's what I would be focused on then. And now I'm focused on much more on the smaller details as we're going along.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got one from Diana. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. What do you do when you write yourself in a corner?
Writing yourself into a corner is another one of those situations where you suddenly have an opportunity to do something awesome. If you find yourself written into a corner and stuck, you need to look at this as a creative challenge to you to figure out a way to get out of it. There are times, actually, no, I can't say that because I've often felt that I was written into a corner, but what that really is, when you've put yourself in the corner, you know the cool way you're going to get out of that. It is in your head. It's not necessarily in your conscious mind, but you know it, or you wouldn't have put yourself there. Writing is a lot about talking to our instinctive writer as well as our conscious writer. You know, our instinctive storyteller knows that there is an awesome, cool way to get out of that. And you have to figure out how to do it and how to do it without either without undermining anything you've done before, you know, without, I mean, you can't just you know, have somebody suddenly sprout a new superpower, for example, to get out of a problem. You don't want to do that. But if you do need something cool like that, then that's a cue that you need to go back in and add the basis for that in earlier in the story. And you want to add it in on a couple of beats, a couple of times earlier in the story to get him out of that, to get him out of that problem at the end. And that will also be something that people will look at and go, oh, he had that planned all the way back at the beginning. No, you didn't. You went back in and added it in, but that's okay. We're Time Lords here. We get to do that.
I really like that. Time Lords of our own creation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's something that a lot of writers feel a lot of anxiety over, is specifically that first draft. The first draft has to be perfect. No, just get the words on paper, put the clay on the wheel, go back and shape it, you know, add stuff if you need to.
And you can do that. I mean, it doesn't have to be a huge pull your hair out reworking to do it either. You can figure out how to do it in ways that you can just slip in a few sentences, a couple of paragraphs earlier on, maybe one little scene that you might need earlier on to set up what you need to get out of the, to get your character out of the box he's in later in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Another question from Diana. Show up. There we go. Okay. How do you balance the magical elements with the realism of an urban setting? How do you make the supernatural feel believable in the modern world?
I use Mark Twain's formula. Mark Twain said that for every fantastic or unbelievable element that you've got in a book, you have to have two completely identifiable concrete elements in the book. So, yeah, Harry Dresden's the wizard with phenomenal cosmic power, but he has trouble making his bills, and his car just is never working right when he needs it to, you know. And that's stuff that we can totally identify with as regular human beings, and pull stuff out of your own life experience, stuff that frustrates you, stuff that, I mean, it's giving you a hard time anyway. You might as well use it to make you some money. If there's stuff, it's stuff that you have issues with, that is continually your problem. I've got an ongoing life theme of having plumbing issues in my home. I will not mind adding that in, as this is something that is continually happening to this person on a regular basis. And that will, you know, that is stuff that will ground the reader in stuff that is identifiable and real. So when you throw in something that is completely whack-a-loon, you know, then they'll be like, oh yeah, well, I can believe the completely whack-a-loon because look at these two things that I'm completely familiar with that are going along with it. So basically it's sort of like the compliment sandwich, you know, you want reality, weird fantasy thing here in the middle.
I really like that structure. We're going to remember that, guys. Put that in the Let's Talk Craft channel. Okay, so one from Matthew Quitone. Who is on your Mount Rushmore of authors?
Robert B. Parker is right up at the top. He was the one who wrote the Spencer Private Eye novels. He passed here about 10 years ago. Lois McMaster Bujold, I think, is probably the most skilled and talented writer working today. She's not doing novels anymore. She just self-publishes novellas to Amazon. But her Miles Vorkosigan book, she's won more Hugos than anyone else alive. Her Miles Vorkosigan books are amazing. She is so able to take character and plot and story world and blends them so seamlessly that you can't tell where one starts and the other stops. I hope I can be as good a writer as her when I'm grown up.
One day.
Yeah, one day. I hope I will be. Let me think who else. Dean Koontz is still one of my favorite writers. He is a solid story structure guy. You can look at all of his work and it works the same way. There's always going to be people. Sanderson is probably one of the better guys working right now. Brandon. I saw another question over here recommending who would I recommend to look at other than the fantasy fiction formula by my old teacher, Deborah Chester. Go look at Sanderson's. He puts his writing classes on YouTube. Go look at him and listen to what he's got to say. I don't agree with him on absolutely everything, but he is a brilliant writer. He's a brilliant person. And, you know, he really has some good stuff to show you.
Yeah. And he makes a lot of money doing it. So he also understands, like, there's the business aspect of it too, that I think he brings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. My son, I taught my son how to write over the course of several years. And when I wasn't teaching him, he was going out and reading Sanderson's stuff and watching Sanderson's stuff. So, you know, his writing has come out of blend between Sanderson's and mine, which seems, that seems a viable commercial place to be, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. You mentioned the Hugos a little bit ago. Are you going to be at WorldCon this year?
Don't think so.
Dang it.
No, I'll be there. We'll my home con is Dragon Con. I'll do Dragon Con. Mm-hmm. I'll do Dragon Con and usually I try and go to a little con and a medium sized con, and then whichever ones my publishers tell me to go to. So yeah, I'm also going to be at, yeah. I'll be at New York Comic Con, and they're going to be handing out arcs of the next Dresden book there. So, you know,
I wasn't adding that to my list, but it might be on my list now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you might be able to get one. I don't know how many they're going to have, but they're apparently going to be handing some out or raffling them or something.
Amazing. So this is a similar question to the last one you had. Which author would cause you to fangirl if you ran into them?
I did fangirl all over Stan Lee.
Fair.
Yeah, Stan Lee walked in. I was at New York Comic Con for the premiere of the Dresden Files TV show, and I was in the green room, you know, kind of getting my breath after a very busy day of doing stuff. Stan Lee comes rolling in, and I'm there with my editor, and I'm like, oh my God, that's Stan Lee. And she's like, you need to go over and introduce yourself to him. I said, I can't do that. That's Stan Lee. She goes, oh my God, Jim, you're such a child. She takes me by the hand, leads me over to Stan Lee, says, hello, Stan. My name is Ann Sowers. I'm an editor with Penguin. And this is one of our authors, Jim Butcher. He'd really like to meet you. And I go, I wrote a Spider-Man book, Stan. And Stan's like, oh, Jim Butcher, it's great to meet you, Jim Butcher, because, you know, now I'm going to be able to talk to people and say, I was talking to Jim Butcher today. I'm a name dropper, Jim. And I was like, that's great, Stan. You're awesome.
That's the best thing.
Yeah, yeah. He was such a sweet guy. He came rolling in, you know, at that New York Manhattan speed walk, you know, kind of trailing this comet of people 50 years younger than him trying to keep up, you know.
Oh, I love that. That's also good impersonation. Very spot on.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. We've got another question from Matthew Quitone. Is there anything you would add or take away from your early novels?
No, because that seems churlish. Things went so well. Why would I want to change it? You know?
Yeah, you are.
Yeah. I mean, if I could, I guess maybe I would have thought through some of the magic system and stuff more, and perhaps made a few different choices early on. But nothing really specific, and it's worked out so well. You know, why? I think it came out, I mean, especially given that the first one was just a project to prove to my teacher how wrong she was. I don't want to rock the boat here karmically, you know, so I'm just going to be happy with what I've done and keep going.
Yeah. Oh, love that. Okay, we've got time for a few more questions here. So, Jim, when did you realize you hit the point where the dream job writing became the day job?
That was when I sold my second series. I got the Alara series sold, and I turned to my ex and I said, okay, well, if you don't want to engineer anymore, I think I could support us with the writing at this point. And she was kind of blown away by that, and then kind of worked out that way. And a couple years after that, the TV show came out, and that one added a zero to my income. Once that happened, that was a big deal. I mean, even just a moderate TV show is moderately well-received TV show is a huge deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. Okay. So, we've got another one from Chris here, and he asks, any tips for finding an agent or publisher?
One, the first one I would say is find somebody who writes something like what you're writing. And that's going to be your top tier of people to go headhunt. Because so for me, it was Laurel Hamilton's agent. Because Laurel Hamilton was writing some urban fantasy stuff back then and hardly anybody else was. And I said, okay, well, maybe I could, if she liked that stuff, maybe she'll like my stuff too. And the next thing is to actually get out and meet people and talk to them, and not in a, I really want you to represent me sense, but to go, you know, to go find out who they are. At the writing conference where I met Laurel's agent, and I also met the agent I'm working with now, Jen Jackson, I was there and you know, I kind of rolled into that and I got to meet Laurel and we got started talking about stuff, and I started talking about Buffy and Babylon 5 because those were two of the best written shows on TV at the time. And it turned out that she was a fan as well. And so we got to talk about those shows and how much we loved them. She asked me to lunch with everybody the next day. I go to lunch the next day with like five authors, an editor and a couple and three agents. And you know what? They liked Buffy and Babylon 5 too. So we got to talk about that. And by the end of that weekend, I'd had two agents offer to represent me. And one of them was Jen Jackson, who I'm working with now. And I turned to her and I said, Jen, you rejected me. She says, I know. I said, you rejected me 2 weeks ago. She says, yeah. I said, you rejected me 2 weeks ago with a crooked, you know, a crooked photocopy of a form rejection letter. She's like, yeah, we've got an intern. He's new. And I said, but you want to represent me now? She says, sure. And I said, why? Why now? She says, well, now I know that you like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and you've played the Amber Diceless role-playing game, you know, and that was, you know, that if you get out and meet people, you get them to know your face. You know, you show up at the publishers' panels at conventions. You know, you take your time to introduce yourself to them after. If you do it long enough, eventually they figure you're not going to go away, and they might as well try and work something into this, because that's the main thing you need to have for success as a writer, is the ability to not quit.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think going to conferences is a huge, huge win. Just getting out and talking to people is a whole part of it. Okay, let's fit in one quick last question. Oh, we've got some good ones. How do you avoid cliches in a genre that already has vampires, wizards, werewolves?
Okay, here's my take on cliches. There's no such thing as a cliche, because if you do something with vampires, you know, with vampires, wizards, werewolves, if you do it correctly, you're utilizing archetypes. If you do it incorrectly, it's a cliche. So the way you have to do it is you have to base your story, you have to ground your story solidly. Once you've got your story grounded solidly in good writing craft, nobody's going to look at you and say, oh, that's just a cliche. If you're telling the story with the character and you know, telling the human part of that story, where you're keeping their emotions and their motivations very clear, because you're using good structure when you're writing your sequels between scenes, it's not going to be seen as a cliche. You can add like your own little twist to it to differentiate it from other people, and you kind of have to. You know, you've got to file off the serial numbers and give it a new coat of paint. But everybody's still going to know it's a bicycle. But if it's a bicycle that looks good and works well, they're not going to look at it as, oh, that's a stolen bicycle. They're going to say, oh, that's an archetype. You know, that's an archetypical bicycle. So, I mean, I think the whole cliche thing is mostly just... It's mostly just when you haven't set things up properly within your story. If you've done that, then don't worry so much about cliches or not cliches, because people think a lot of my stuff is really original. I don't think any of it is. I think I'm just retooling things, filing off the serial number, giving it a new coat of paint. But what I do try and make sure that I do is make everybody understandable, identifiable, make sure you know everybody's motivations, make sure the stuff that they're doing makes sense within the world that they're in. And if you can do that, then you're going to create something brand new. We can all start with the same ingredients in the kitchen and try and cook the same dish. It's going to taste different for each of us, because we're going to go about it in different ways. Writing's the same way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up here. Such great questions from everyone. Thank you, Jim, for joining us.
Hey, you're very welcome, guys.
Yeah. Is there a ideal place where people can find more information about upcoming books or anything like that for you?
You can go to jimbutcheronline.com. Or just Google Jim Butcher and I'll be the first one that pops up. There's another guy who writes some travel logs, and another Jim Butcher who wins fishing tournaments all the time, but they don't usually pop up first on Google. So,
yeah. Also, everyone, I've thrown up a QR code for you to be able to purchase the first book of Dresden. If you haven't already, it's our book club this month, by the way. So we'll talk about it next week. Jim, thanks so much for joining us. This was great.
You're very welcome. I'm always happy to talk about writing. Good luck, writers. Don't give up. That's what you need to do. Remember, you don't have to outrun me when you're writing books. You just have to outrun all the people that are around you. You don't have to be faster than the bear, just faster than the guy next to you.
I love that. Thank you so much.
Hang in there. Hang in there. Keep going.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim.
All right. Farewell, y'all.
Bye. Wasn't that awesome? Yeah, I had a really good time chatting with him. Everybody in the chat had a great time. The Discord kind of blew up afterward with people just very excited about it. So I'm really grateful and really glad that Mr. Jim Butcher got to hang out with us for an hour and just talk writing craft. It was great. So regarding those announcements, and kind of some stuff around the lab. First announcement, we are actually going to be releasing a charity anthology next month. It's called Yesterday's Tomorrow. I'll show off the cover here in a few days. I'm still waiting on a little bit of finalization. Honestly, by the time that this video releases or this podcast releases, it'll already, like, you'll already see the cover. So, but yeah, it's a charity anthology. So all the stories inside were donated by members of the lab. It is all the editing, the cover art, everything was donated, which is amazing. And all of the proceeds, so everything that, every purchase that comes from this goes to a nonprofit. And that nonprofit is freedomreads.org. And they are a wonderful organization that puts libraries inside prison cells. So very excited to be able to support them and get some wonderful, really interesting stories off of the theme Yesterday's Tomorrow. We wanted the theme to kind of match Worldcon this year, where their theme is like the future of tomorrow or something like that. And so we wanted it to match because we're going to actually try and release, like, have the launch day for that anthology at Worldcon, which, by the way, I will have a table for the Fiction Lab at Worldcon. So if you are going to be at Worldcon, please stop by the table. We're going to be in the fan exhibit area. So please come check us out. We'd love to see you. We're probably going to try and do some cool, like, murder bot game. So please stop by and check that out. We'll have lots of like goodies you can walk off with. So yeah, that's the anthology. And then some details around the Fiction Lab. We're an online writers group. We have a Discord. There's a free version. There's a paid version. But you get access to all of this fun stuff, get to connect with other writers. And then there's some like publishers, editors. We might have an audiobook narrator in there, like cover art designer. So like you can find industry experts directly in the lab, which is great. I've got them tagged by role, so you can even see who's a publisher, who's an editor, and connect with them. But yeah, that's the Fiction Lab. Oh, one other announcement. Very excited about this one. I also got a table for the Fiction Lab at Dragonsteel Nexus this year. So if you're going to be at Brando Sandoz Conference, I will be there. So very, very excited about that one. I'm going to spend more money than I make there. And I can't wait. I'm so excited. Anyway, thanks for joining us. This has been a great time. And yeah, check out our podcast. Subscribe, like, and subscribe, please. That would be great. Support the lab. Come join us if you're a writer. And yeah, thanks, everyone. Also, you can probably hear Paul barking outside. So he's got lots to say to the squirrel that keeps coming by. Bye.